I'm Jason Van Medi.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
Welcome to Disasters Deconstructed podcast.
So the first month or so of the podcast has been cool, right?
I know, it's week six. How exciting. I mean, time flies.
It does. It seems like we've been doing this for a long time. I suppose we've been planning and practicing and recording for a long time. We would love to hear from people who have learned something or who have some questions or comments about the episodes. Please share on Twitter, especially because that's kind of where we focus a lot of our energy, on keeping up the Twitter account and the dialogue on there.
Yes, we'd love to hear from you. It's really important for us to know what you think, so we don't just do it for ourselves.
We have a lot of really great stuff coming up after Disaster Ingredients. Today is the third part of that series. We have some other episodes coming up where we're going to explore other disaster concepts and talk a lot more about the root causes of disaster and some of the problems about language, which we've started to explore in the season, but we haven't gone into depth yet.
And we have some very cool guests coming.
So today we have a friend of both of ours coming in to talk to us, Lee Boscher from Loughborough University. Ksenia, you work right down the hall from Lee, right? Or next door?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's one door away. So yeah, Lee and I, we're kind of 5 meters apart from each other. So, you know, I get to talk to Lee pretty much every day, which is great. And for me, I guess it's particularly exciting to interview Lee, you know, or to chat to Lee on the podcast today, because it's because of Lee that I'm in disaster studies. He employed me as his postdoctoral researcher in 2012, I think, so 7 years ago. And he, you know, he really mentored me and he really helped me with my career development, kind of with the way I'm thinking about disasters. So yeah, a lot of what I'm doing now is because of Lee. And I guess he introduced you and me as well, right? So
yeah,
very cool.
He did introduce us, but I also feel like from a distance, he's been a mentor to me as well in disaster studies. You know, he kind of helped me to understand a lot of things about the field and about the academic community, and we've kept that up over the years, and I've learned a lot from Lee. So I feel like I owe a lot of gratitude to Lee, and it's really exciting to talk to him today. It's good to have you with us, Lee.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Hi, Lee.
Hello.
I think we can call you a friend of the show, can't we?
Yes, definitely. I've listened to all the podcasts so far, so I've got a good insight into the high standards that I've been that your guests are bringing to the discussions.
Hopefully you'll visit us frequently on our podcast.
Yeah, more than happy to. Every week, is it so far?
Yeah.
Well, we probably can't have you on every week, but we'll see what we can do.
No, I'll listen in every week. I'm sure what once a decade will be enough for me. So,
well, I guess, Lee, it's because of you that I'm in disaster studies. So yeah, anything you can blame it on Lee, actually, yeah. All the research I produce.
Apologies for that.
And also, you were the one who introduced Jason and me, so even this podcast is kind of because of you.
Yeah.
So Lee, how did you end up working on disasters?
Right, well, I think perhaps similar to quite a lot of people who end up working in the sort of disaster science, disaster risk management field, I was affected by a disaster. So without going into the details, I was backpacking around India in 1996 and got caught up in a tropical cyclone which affected the east coast of India and Andhra Pradesh around the East Godavari Delta region. And I saw the devastation and the impacts of that, and it was okay for me. I managed to get some road transport out of the affected area and traveled on my merry way down to Chennai in the south of India. And then a few months later, as part of the same trip, I found myself in Kathmandu, and my money was running short, and I decided to head for Freak Street, which is one of the cheaper backpacker areas of Kathmandu. And I didn't have enough money to stay in the hotel that I wanted to. So I ended up staying in quite a sort of old, decrepit lodge, which I could just sort of barely afford. And that night, first night I was there, there was a minor tremor, earthquake. And the accommodation I was in sort of coped okay. It was timber framed, it flexed, and there wasn't any damage. But the building, the hotel that I wanted to stay in, the more fancier, modern and more expensive one, suffered partial damage and some people got injured in that. So it sort of brought to my sort of horizon, basically, that there were these disasters going on, and there were various sort of underlying root causes as to why earthquakes and cyclones, for example, were affecting some people more than others. And as a consequence of that, I came back to the UK and did a degree in development and health and disaster management at Coventry University as a mature student. And then straight from there, after getting my degree in 2000, I did a PhD at the Flood Hazard Research Centre at Middlesex University under the great supervisory role of Edmund Penning Rousell. And I went back out to East Godavery in Andhra Pradesh in East India and did my field work there.
Thank you. I don't think many people know your story, so there you go. It's all public now.
So Lee, in the last couple of weeks, we've been running this series, as you know, about the different ingredients of disasters. And so today we're talking about exposure. And the first thing I want to ask is, like, how would you explain the concept of exposure to a lay audience?
Good question. So from my perspective, I think too often exposure and vulnerability get used in the same way, but I think there is a distinctive difference. So I see exposure as a necessary but not necessarily the only sort of determinant of risk. So exposure is the extent to which you're in the firing line, so to speak, and expect then there's a vulnerability aspect, which is you might be in the firing line, but are you more or less likely to be affected by the firing line, if that makes sense?
It does. And I guess when we talk about exposure, we often have this very physical framing of it. Is there a socioeconomic aspect to exposure, or is it the sort of interface with the vulnerability of a society?
Yeah, there clearly is a socioeconomic aspect to exposure. So I'll give you some examples, hopefully, which will sort of illustrate the rationale behind this. So,
okay.
So one of the interesting things when I've been in the time I've done my research is that you have this strange situation where rich people who live in the Thames, along the River Thames, people who live on the steep hillsides in California, which might be prone to landslides and forest fires, actually pay a premium to live in those hazardous areas because of the benefits, the other benefits that they can provide. So views of the river, access to your yacht or your canoe on the riverbank, views of the sea, or being in an area where you're surrounded by the forests. So some people in the more wealthier nations perhaps pay a premium for living in those areas, which actually makes them quite exposed. In contrast, there are billions of people through lack of choice and lack of options who live in exposed areas, so geographically exposed areas, because they don't have a choice. So, for example, people who live on floodplains, particularly in informal settlements or slums in large cities, so along the riverbanks, prone to flooding, they live there because that's the only sort of available land that they can sort of temporarily settle on. So you get this sort of strange sort of clash between some people choose to live in exposed areas from a natural hazards perspective because they're paying more for the benefits or what they see the benefits of living in those areas, whereas actually I think there's a lot of people, relatively poor people, who live in exposed areas through lack of choices. So that's, I think that's where the socioeconomic aspect then comes in, because that has a bearing on whether people have a choice or don't have a choice in those exposed areas.
But you know, you're talking about the choice. So those who choose to live in the exposed areas for whatever benefit, you know, for the view or, you know, convenience. Do you think this is their actual conscious choice that, you know, I will go and buy an expensive house in a flood-prone area? Or is this something in the way we promote those benefits as a society?
Well, yeah, it's the way that they're promoted, but also I think typically people who are quite well off might tend to have safety nets in place anyway, where, you know, if they do get flooded or if the house does get affected by a fallen tree or a bit of a landslide, they're going to have some sort of insurance cover, which makes it less of a pressing concern for them. And I do think that some people do live in hazard-prone areas. They're aware of it, but they're actually out of the balance between the likelihood of something bad happening and the potential for the daily fantastic views they get or the nice cool breezes that they get for being up the hill. That's the trade-off that they're prepared to make. Also cases where some people, for example in the UK, live in hazard prone areas through lack of knowledge, you might want to say ignorance. You know, 1 in 10 new houses built in England in the last 30 years has been built in a high flood risk area, and people are buying those houses even though they might be built on something called the Water Meadows estate near a river, very prone to flooding, and then they're sort of up in arms when, after they've bought the house, 2 or 3 years later, their house gets flooded. So I think some people enter this sort of trade-off with a good bit of knowledge, but actually quite a lot sort of enter this sort of trade-off with not a lot of knowledge.
And why isn't the government doing anything about it? You know, it sounds like exposure is something, is the easiest thing to address, well, the easiest, you know. But an obvious, I guess, thing to address.
Yeah, there's, I think the government do some things, but overall, I think particularly somewhere like the UK, where as part of this sort of neoliberal agenda, we've sort of, that the government have devolved responsibility to local authorities. So I think as a consequence, that sounds good because it's decision-making force at the local authority level, but ultimately it means that local authority decision makers come into sort of conflict with sometimes quite large scale property developers. And thus that's sometimes a little bit of an unfair battle to fight. So for example, you know, if the government are saying local authorities in the UK, again, for example, need to be building so many thousands of houses every year, it makes it hard for the local authorities to actually start turning down planning applications for developments in hazardous areas. And sometimes decisions are overturned by central government anyway. So ultimately, there's a big developmental lobby, a big construction lobby, which has quite a lot of power when it comes to, I think, forcing the government or the local government's hands on these matters. And that's in the UK. So imagine a situation where there isn't clear planning procedures, there isn't strictly enforced building regulations, and it's basically an open door policy for inappropriate development in many parts of the world.
So the creation of risk is really profitable for some actors, right?
Yes, it is. And unfortunately, the actors who it's profitable for also, because they have financial clout, also can buy political power, and that can have a bearing on the decision making which is made at governmental and local governmental levels.
Yeah, so I guess one of the ways in which risk is being increased in society is this increased exposure of people and assets. The other thing I was thinking when you were talking was about the importance of looking at the perception of risk among different people, depending on their assets, depending on, like you said, the safety net that they have. And it reminds me of some of the stories I heard after some of the big bushfires in Australia when I was living there, of the recovery process being characterized by new people coming into the community who had no knowledge of that risk environment, and assuming that things like, you know, the return rate of a hazard was meant that it wasn't going to happen for a certain period of years. And I think we've talked about this before, Lee. You know, what does a 1 in 100 year flood mean to different people, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's let alone thinking about how accurate these hazard return periods are, for example, floods, which are pretty much based on historical incidents and not really factoring in climate change impacts, makes this 1 in 100 year, 1 in 200 year flood terminology problematic anyway, but particularly in the way, as you say, that people interpret that. And to a lot of people, you know, if you say a 1 in 100 year flood, and I think, well, it was a flood 5 years ago,
yeah,
so there's not going to be another one for another 95 plus years.
Yeah, exactly.
So it is a problematic term. Differences between the UK and other parts of the world. I mean, in the UK, for example, we don't have lots of natural hazards that we need to deal with compared to places like the US and New Zealand and many Asian countries such as India and Indonesia. But people, so I think the hazards and sort of the impact of hazards on our day-to-day lives is quite low on the things we need to worry about. Many people, maybe things like Brexit is more of a concern now. So yeah. I don't think it's the first thing that people think about. But I always talk to my undergraduate students when I on an undergraduate disaster risk management module for civil engineering students, and you know, ask them whether they know if their student accommodation or their parents' house is in the flood risk area, and hardly any of them have ever checked, and hardly any of them ever know. And the ones who do know, the few that do know, they only know because the house has been flooded. You know, but there's information out there, and to check whether your house is in a flood risk area. And for the biggest ever investment that people will make in their lives, the fact that they don't take it on board to actually look and check those hazard maps themselves is I think a bit bizarre, to be honest. But I might be saying that because I'm coming from a disaster risk management background. So I think in the UK those sort of things are very low on the agenda, but also because they don't happen very often. But then when the research we've looked at in places like Indonesia and India and even Vietnam to some extent, is that also, natural hazards might be more prevalent, but because people have got so many other things going on in their lives, they don't have social support networks, and they don't have good health care, and maybe their kids, you know, are forced to leave school at an early age to earn some money, that, you know, things like floods, which might happen every 5 or 10 years, and tropical cyclones or storms that might happen once every 20 years, aren't, again, high on their day-to-day agendas. They've got daily battles that they need to fight, whereas the sort of large-scale events become less of an issue for them because, as a lady in India said to me, I'd be quite happy to still be around when the next big disaster occurs.
Yeah.
She saw her life as a day-to-day challenge, a day-to-day crisis.
Yeah.
We kind of start talking about numbers, and I want to talk a little bit more about that. So, you know, the way we define exposure, I guess, 100 years, you know, is about numbers. And also, generally, we look at the exposure through either a number of people that are affected or a number that of people that are dead, or in monetary terms, in a way that assets have been affected. So, you know, we always want quantification when it comes to the exposure, but we know that not everything is quantifiable. So how should we go about it? How should we talk about exposure without numbers? Or can we talk about exposure without numbers?
I think you're going to need some numbers at some stage, but they're only part of a very complex picture. And I do have my concerns. Obviously, people talk about the risk equation, which is risk equals hazard times exposure times vulnerability. Yeah. But the fact that it's sort of couched as an equation almost sort of implies that you put the numbers in and it's almost some sort of algorithm that it gives you some number at the end, which helps you to know what the level of risk is. But I don't think it's that straightforward. And I think if any efforts to quantify things too much is overly reductionist when it comes to doing research. So I think what we need to do is actually embrace the complexity, and embracing the complexity will be done through doing good, you know, physical science, understanding the hazards and doing better research on the impacts of climate change and return periods for hazards. That's fine, but also that needs to be done in conjunction with very good in-depth research on the underlying root causes of why some sections of society are more likely to be affected by hazards than others. So the socioeconomic, the political issues which are underpinning these problems that people are having to cope with, and why some people in a particular part of town might be overly affected by a flood when other people in a neighbouring street might not be as affected at all. So to sort of understand that, that is what we need to get to the bottom of. And so numbers have a role to play, but we also need the qualitative information. And of course, I'm biased because I'm a social scientist, but I think arguably doing one without the other becomes meaningless. And we need to work as groups of researchers to actually couple these research methods and methodologies together to come up with the good, insightful understanding of risk that's required.
So Lee, how do you think we should go about reaching some people or audiences that might not appreciate those sort of unquantifiable factors and data?
We can be overly dismissive sometimes and say, yes, that is overly reductionist and that is you know, part of the story. But I think it's important to actually build collaborations by highlighting to people who do research into volcanography or whatever it might be, that is a part of the picture and a very important part. But also that there's a bunch of researchers who bring these other components, which might be based on anthropology and political sciences, which actually can build a bigger, more richer picture of what the issues are, how those hazards interact with societies and with communities. So it's sort of, yeah, you're doing great work. We need to work with each other on this. And interestingly, I think there's a sign of that happening in the UK where some of the research councils in particular, particularly the Natural and Environmental Research Council, NERC, are sort of in a way forcing academics to work on proposals where the natural hazards aspect is and the people who do science in that are working with social and anthropological and political sciences, and to work co-produce proposals with local stakeholders and do research where those range of scientific approaches are going to be they're going to be smashed together, basically. You know, they're going to be forced to work with each other. So I think there is hope, but it is challenging.
Thinking about in some of the most extreme so-called disaster events, some would argue that it's more about the exposure factor than vulnerability. For example, the Asian tsunami, UNICR published that, you know, people were indiscriminately impacted by that. So do you agree with that sort of assessment in extreme disaster events?
I'm not sure that view that it was mainly down to exposure was the main factor, for example, in the Asian tsunami. Again, I think that's sort of trying to simplify things which aren't that easy to simplify. Mm. I mean, you could make a counter argument and saying that tourists who were there in on the beaches in Thailand and in Sri Lanka and places like that, for example, were arguably more exposed because they, and this is a problem we're seeing in many other parts of the world, you sort of alluded to it earlier, where people move from one part of a country to another and don't necessarily know the sort of hazard or risk profiles in that area. So you had people from Europe, for example, in some of these tourist resorts who were in a lot of cases very oblivious to tsunami risk. Mm. And thus, when the sea started to recede, some of the tourists were walking out and thinking, "Wow, this is interesting." And I think there's a famous mm-hmm. case of a schoolgirl from Scandinavia who warned the parents that it was a sign that a tsunami was coming. Mm-hmm. So in those particular cases, you could argue that those tourists were perhaps more exposed than some of the local population. However, whether those tourists, which were from outside of Asia, were more affected in the short and long term than the local population is questionable.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you have to think about, yes, maybe everybody had an experience at that point in time, but what did the recovery look like for different groups of people, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was interesting as well, actually, with this Asian tsunami, that it was Swedish resilience policy that has completely changed after that. It was kind of a big point to start thinking about disaster risk reduction for them because so many tourists have been affected.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, in simple forms, you know, exposure is an important part of the risk equation, if you want to use that terminology, but there's a difference between exposure and vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And the socioeconomic and political factors which determine somebody's vulnerability and might have an impact on their exposure, or determines their exposure, which then might have an impact on their vulnerability. So I think to overly focus on one might be sort of distracting from some of the key messages. Can have an important part in actually trying to sort of play down what might be important aspects. I saw it when I did my research in India, where, you know, the World Bank sort of language was, you know, actually the richer you get, the less likely you're going to be affected by disasters, which might sound fine, but in an Indian context it wasn't quite as straightforward as that. And I used caste as an analytical variable and found out that people's education, the types of jobs they got, the political connections they had, the social networks they had were very much determined by their caste, which isn't something you can break away from, irrespective of how well off you get. So, you know, I think the way we look at these things, the language we use, the analytical variables that we use, we should use as many as possible and then determine what the key factors are once we've done that.
Absolutely. Wow, a lot to digest, and I think we could be talking to you for hours and hours. But yeah, thanks, Lee. As always, you know, it's amazing to talk to you, and thank you for giving us your time today.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I think the podcast's a great idea, and I know Ksenia and Jason have done a great job. It's a great initiative, and it's one of the first things I listen to each week when they come out. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to spout off a little bit during this.
Thank you.
I really appreciate that, Lee. And just to remind everyone that Disasters Deconstructed is available wherever you get your podcast. It's released every Monday. And you can follow us and tweet us at DisastersDecon, and we're also on Instagram.
You You have been listening to Ksenia, Jason, and me, Lee, on Disasters Deconstructed Podcast. Thank you for listening.